I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome back to Radio Times. President Obama won Pennsylvania's 20 electoral votes last night, defeating Governor Romney, who made a last-ditch effort to win over voters. Romney and his well-heeled supporters invested millions in TV ads in the final days of the campaign. Pennsylvania also has its first female attorney general, Democrat Kathleen Kane. Democrats running for treasurer and auditor general both won last night, and Senator Robert Casey beat back a challenge from Republican Tom Smith. To our Pennsylvania listeners, any questions or comments about the results of last night's election, or elections, I should say, give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We ask Chris Bork to join us once again. When we talk about politics, we often call him up. He's Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the Institute of Public Opinion at Muhlenberg College. And Chris, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks, Marty. Glad to be back.
Was there ever any doubt in your mind that Obama would win Pennsylvania?
You know, very little doubt, Marty. When you look at the numbers game in Pennsylvania, it is a very hard road for a Republican candidate to go down. If you just think last night, if turnout in Philadelphia was even fairly good, and it was very good for Barack Obama in terms of the overall margin, it's hard to make up in the rest of the state. President Obama won Philadelphia by about 450,000 votes, and the rest of the state, you know, if you took the whole state in terms of making that margin up, it would be an uphill battle. So I think it was more of a bluff on the part of the Romney campaign and a little bit of trying to show that they were expanding the race, when in the end they were just taking a long shot on the state.
And how did the president and Governor Romney, how did they do in the suburbs surrounding Philadelphia?
Well, that was the key. You know, a lot of the suspicion was that the suburbs would be a harder sell for President Obama in 2012 compared to 2008. And indeed, he didn't do as well. But overall, he won the Philadelphia suburbs again. He basically split Chester and Bucks. They're right around 50-50, with Bucks leaning towards to President Obama and Chester leaning towards Governor Romney. Again, really close races. But Obama did exceedingly well in Montgomery County and in Delaware County, winning not quite by the margins he did in 2008, but handily. And that, you know, just to make the math work for Republicans in the state with that big margin coming out of Philadelphia, he would have had to have an exceptional night in the suburbs. And not only did he not have an exceptional night, he lost the suburbs, he being Romney.
And was turnout up across the state for the Republicans and the Democrats and even the independent candidates?
Well, overall turnout, we're not sure at the final numbers right now, but it looks like it won't be quite at 2008 levels, but not in terms of overall mm-hmm. turnout, not a bad night at all, and probably in comparison with modern presidential races in the state, fairly good. And so that turnout, again, was a suspect. A lot of people had suspicion that, especially for Democrats, it wouldn't be as good. But I don't think those concerns were borne out by the final results.
So why do you think Governor Romney came into Pennsylvania just a couple of days before the election? He was in Bucks County for what sounded like a pretty large rally that was on Sunday.
You know, Marty, it's a bit of rolling the dice, right? I think as he saw the polling numbers in other places like Ohio not moving for him, and eventually probably looking at those same numbers in places like Virginia and Florida, I think he wanted to roll the dice. Pennsylvania had 20 electoral votes. It made for good visuals to come to a state he hadn't come to before and make a pitch. Had a nice rally here, you know, for campaign-starved Republicans in places like Bucks County that hadn't had a chance to really go out and have their moment. So it made for a good evening. But I would be very confident that within the Romney campaign itself, looking at their internal polls, that they knew the math that seemed almost everybody else did, that it was a very long shot to win here.
You mentioned that looks like the president largely won the suburbs around Philadelphia, but it also looks like the incumbents running for re-election for Congress won as well.
It was, you know, it tells you a lot about the state of congressional races in the state, in Pennsylvania, Marty. incumbents had a great night in Pennsylvania over all of the 18 congressional districts. Only one incumbent lost, and that's where two districts were put together out west in the 12th congressional district. And that was the only race, only one race in the state out of our 18 congressional districts was within a 10-point margin.
Wow.
In other words, for the 17 other districts besides the 12th, the margin of victory was over 10 points, which, you know, one word, gerrymandering. We've made these districts incredibly uncompetitive, and even in places where there was lots of competition in other races, the way those district lines were drawn made it a very good night for incumbents and very few dramatic moments at all throughout the congressional races in the state.
But it also seems to indicate that there was some split voting, that while the president won Pennsylvania, a number of Republican members of Congress were reelected.
Yeah, you look at suburban Philadelphia, and you can imagine there were quite a few split tickets. And you know, when you have candidates in places like the 8th congressional district and the 6th and the 7th, especially the 6th with Jim Gerlach, who have appealed to the more moderate voters in those districts, I would imagine there were quite a few split ballots. And again, you know, even with those split ballots that occur, the way those lines are drawn, they really carved up corridors of Republicans and Democrats to keep it less competitive than we otherwise would see.
And that's Chris Borg, Associate Professor of Political Science, Director of the Institute of Public Opinion at Muhlenberg College in Pennsylvania, the first of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. And we're spending the first segment of the show talking about some of the election results here in Pennsylvania. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Chris, let me see what Christine from Sellersville has to say. And Christine, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
I am
up in Upper Bucks County, and I volunteered for the Obama campaign going all the way back to just before our primary. And over the course of the last several months, I made calls, knocked on doors, the whole thing. But I have to say, my biggest takeaway in all of this is a completely newfound appreciation for all that happens at the local level by everyday citizens, poll watchers, poll workers, judges of elections, committee people, all that, you know, pitch in to make elections happen. And like I said, it's an incredible perspective that I gained, and I was really impressed and inspired by the whole you know, the whole commitment that I made over the last several months.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Chris Borg, there is a whole machinery of voting that gets into gear every 2 years.
Oh, it is. And Christine's absolutely right. When you look at the amount of human hours spent in the state, largely by individuals volunteering to do this work, to make sure the election process goes off without a hitch, and it's something that the individuals in the state can have confidence in, and those hours are it's true public service, and the same with her work with the Obama or the Democratic campaign, as she said, and for all those that worked with the Republican Party, those are it's the lifeblood of a democracy to have those individuals involved, and you know, to get out the vote efforts on the part, you know, we give so much credit to the technical aspects, the structures of doing that, but so much of it comes down to human resources, having people knock on the doors and go out and encourage individuals to vote and make the phone call. So I'm glad that she was part of it, and there was a heavy dose of that throughout the state.
Christine, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Chris, let me ask you about some of the races here. Kathleen Kane is the new Attorney General in Pennsylvania, the first woman to win, and this is an elected office since 1980. My understanding is she's the first Democrat to win this office.
Yeah, historic on two levels. She is the first woman elected to office in this position, and the first Democrat, and had a really outstanding night. She outperformed all other Democrats in the state. She ran a campaign that I think was well suited for the environment, and in some ways she played off a bit of Governor Corbett's unpopular standing in the polls, using his role in the Jerry Sandusky investigation, which is still raises a lot of questions in the state and in terms of the public. There's some dissatisfaction with how that was handled. She made that a central issue, and really ran a campaign that was that you had to look at as incredibly effective in terms of, again, winning by about 15 points for an office that had never been won before by a Democratic candidate. And it'll be interesting now to see how she actually follows up on those issues in terms of possible investigations into the investigation.
Let me ask you about the Senate race, the U.S. Senate race. Robert Casey and Tom Smith. Casey did win, but I know there was some concern from his supporters that he wasn't being enthusiastic enough or taking the challenge from Tom Smith seriously enough.
Well, Marty, I'd have to call it one of the most low-key campaigns I've
really?
Seen on a statewide level. You know, and Bob Casey is a very low-key elected official. I mean, I think that's part of his personality and who he is. And so, you don't expect you know firebrand speeches and incredible oratory and you know hitting the stump hard. But he played it very low-key, and in the end, the Casey campaign knew what it was doing. You know, they won that race by about 8 percentage points. Mm-hmm. You know, they took a hit. Tom Smith used his money, about $20 million of his own cash, over the course of this campaign to really bring down Casey's public standing, personal favorability, and approval ratings almost directly from August into early October. But that stopped in early October, and Casey was able to, when the race got as close as most polls had it, he was able to run his own ads and do a little bit of defining of Smith as a Tea Party candidate, which was very popular in this particular election cycle. And even though his low-key race had some people scratching their heads, Casey folks can say, you know, we had it pretty much in hand and won by 8 points.
But it's interesting to look at the state now. So you have a Republican legislature, a Republican governor, one Republican senator, and then you have some of these new Democratic faces.
It's what an interesting state in so many
it
ways,
is,
Marty.
In many ways.
As you just said, look at our row offices were dominated by Democrats last night. Treasurer, Auditor General, Attorney General, obviously the high-profile Senate and presidential races. Yet our congressional delegation is dominated by Republicans now. We have a conservative Republican senator, a Republican governor, and then control of the House and Senate by Republicans. So we may not be a swing state any longer in terms of presidential politics, but I think in terms of our overall political environment, we can consider ourselves purple.
A purple. There you go. We all like purple. Chris Bork, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the Institute of Public Opinion, that's at Muhlenberg College. He's the first of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, checking in on a number of issues that we're caring about. And we'll be talking about polls and pollsters and pundits after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Penn's Department of Dermatology supports WHYY. Do you have moderate to severe psoriasis? Penn is conducting a psoriasis clinical research study to determine if FDA-approved psoriasis treatments such as Humira, compared to phototherapy or placebo, improve cutting-edge markers of cardiovascular disease. To participate, you must be 18 or older and have psoriasis that covers 10% of your body. Info at 215-662-SKIN. 215-662-SKIN.
This Week on This American Life. Everybody knows that politics is now so divided in our country. The two sides are like two different realities, two versions of the world in collision. This week on our show, we hear from people who have seen this infect their personal lives. They've lost friends. They've become estranged from family members. Our political civil war and its personal consequences. It's a special election edition of our show this week.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art Craft Show supports WHYY and presents its 36th annual show of juried contemporary American crafts. Jewelry, ceramics, glass, furniture, clothing, and more will be on view at the Pennsylvania Convention Center from November 8th through November 11th. 25 artists from Britain and Ireland will be featured. The Philadelphia Museum of Art Craft Show from November 8th through 11th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center. Tickets available at the door. For details, pmacraftshow.org.
This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. The 2012 election will be known for a number of things, including the use, the misuse, and the number of polls. There was an interesting trend that caught my eye, a kind of battle between pollsters and pundits. We asked Simon Jagman to join us. He's a professor of political science and statistics at Stanford University, co-director of the Stanford Center for American Democracy, and one of the principal investigators of the American National Election Studies, and that's the longest running survey-based study of American political behavior and public opinion. He's developed his own poll averaging model called Pollster, which is published by Huffington Post. And Simon Jagman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments about polls, do give us a call. So, Simon Jagman, much talk this morning about how President Obama won re-election. Is it fair to say that pollsters won as well?
Collectively, they did. Across the industry, and that's what we're effectively measuring with these poll averages, the states have lined up pretty much in accordance with, the poll averaging that I was producing, that Nate Silver was producing, that Sam Wang up at Princeton was producing. So at least at that level, you'd say, on average, the polls did quite well.
And my understanding that last night you were predicting that the president had a 91.4% chance of winning. Do I have that right?
That's right.
And do people, do you think, understand what people like you and Nate Silver and Sam Wang are doing, which is poll averaging? And is there a way to describe that on the radio without a lot of graphs?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
The idea is that if you've got, say, let's just take the case of two polls. You're always better off if you could somehow combine the information in the two polls. So if you did a poll of 1,000 people and I did a poll of 1,000 people, each poll has got a margin of error. But if we could combine the information in the two polls somehow, we'd have a smaller margin of error and presumably be more confident in what what that information is telling us about who might be up or down. And so that's the general idea. And then, of course, it's a little delicate because you just don't want to sort of naively jam polls together. You've got to also be alert to the possibility that your poll might be biased in a way, and my poll might also be biased because, I do cell phones and you only do landlines, or I'm on the internet, or, the different ways the pollsters sort of make the sausage, as it were. And so you need to take that into account as well. So it's not just simple averaging or a naive averaging. It's an averaging with one eye on the possibility that any given poll might be carrying around a little bit of bias, or perhaps even a lot of bias, and you want to correct for that at the same time as you take the information that is there in any given poll.
But looking what you and others did, was it then looking at various state polls, looking at track records so that you can reduce some of that margin of error? And I noticed last night tracking some of the pollsters and what they were doing, giving us information about very specific districts in very specific states.
Well, that's right. And so what happens in a contemporary American presidential campaign, there's just so much polling, particularly in swing states. So in Ohio, Florida, Virginia, those states, just to take three, there's just a ton of polling done there. And so when you apply this methodology state by state, particularly to the swing states, you're actually in a pretty good position. Confidence with which you're able to say who's ahead or who's not is actually getting quite good. Mm-hmm. Just given how much information is there across the vast number of polls that get rolled out in those swing states, and again, if you're doing these bias corrections the right way, and you're combining the information properly, by the day before the election, you actually got you can be reasonably confident about what's going to happen. You know, even making calls like we were able to do, reasonably confident that, you know, Obama would win Virginia, reasonably confident that, actually extremely confident that Obama would win Ohio. And but, you know, you'll always have a state like Florida, which, you know, is where they still haven't called it.
I noticed
and
that.
Where for Nate Silver and myself, I think we both ended, you know, literally 50-50 with our predictions for what would happen in that state. Again, just reflecting what the polls were telling us, which turned out to be an extremely accurate representation of what happened on the night.
And what I also notice, there are those national polls that look at popular vote, but that, you know, whether you like it or not, that doesn't really, that's not how we elect presidents. It's the electoral vote that really matters.
Well, that's exactly right. But two things to say about that. One is, nevertheless, the national popular vote is of intense interest to journalists, to people in, you know, the general public. We care about that a lot. The other thing is that in the statistical modeling, that national number tells you an awful lot about
don't
what's going on
phone.
In the States.
Don't answer that phone. Simon, don't answer that phone, okay?
No, I'm not. I just muted it. It tells you an awful lot about what's going on in the States, right? Because it's just a mathematical fact that what's going on in, you know, the nation is just the sum of what's going on in the state. So even if the goal is to make state-level predictions, and that's what you need to do a good electoral college forecast, there's still an awful lot of information there in the national numbers, particularly with respect to states that historically have demonstrated a close correlation that follow the national trend very carefully. And so there's an awful lot of information there on the table, if you will. You wouldn't want to just put the national polls to one side, not at all. They play a really important part, I think, in everybody's models out there. My model, Nate Silver's, another political scientist at Emory University named Drew Linzer, Sam Wang. I think all of us are kind of more or less doing very similar things with the data, including this last thing I was just talking about, integrating what's going on up at the national level with what we think is going on out in the states one by one.
And I notice in the kind of battle between data versus drama that a number of the pundits were calling out Nate Silver, people like you, for almost like calling the race too soon, removing the theatrics of election politics.
It was very interesting, that aspect of it. Nate, you know, came to great national prominence in 2008, you know, flipped over to the New York Times, a great platform for his work, 538 over at the New York Times now, had a book coming out coinciding with the run-up to the election. And I think Nate became the lightning rod for some of this. And I think, you know, to be a little fair here, Nate did go after pundits in a chapter
yes.
in his book. And so to some extent, you know, that fight maybe was always going to happen. But there is a bigger point here, and that is, I think, you know, in an environment where we have all this data, and there's not just Nate, but there's four or five of us looking at it all, fitting similar models that at least now we know have a pretty good performance story to tell. Why wouldn't we avail ourselves of that approach and that information? And I think, you know, to some extent we're looking at nothing other than a turf war between, you know, this approach that offers a very different way of thinking about what's happening in a campaign and what's likely to happen in an election versus traditional punditry, where a columnist will call friends in the campaigns and try and get a sense of what's happening on the ground and all sorts of intangibles, if you will. And I think, you know, Nate's work in particular, but the work of the rest of us, really brought that into stark contrast this time around.
Well, let me quote Nate Silver. He was on the Colbert Report earlier this week, and this is the quote, which I have to say is quite interesting. He says, if pundits were on the ballot against, like, I don't know, Ebola, I might vote Ebola or third party. Fighting words, I guess, there.
Yeah, it's a little colorful, isn't it?
It is a little colorful. let me reintroduce you, Simon, and I do want to get some callers in. We are talking about polls and perhaps even polls versus punsters and the use of data in tracking various elections, including the presidential election this season. And our guest is Simon Jackman, professor of political science and statistics at Stanford University, co-director of the Stanford Center for American Democracy. And he's developed his own poll averaging model. It's called Pollster, published by Huffington Post, and he did give the president a 91.4% chance of winning. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get, looks like Rob from Westchester to join our conversation. And Rob, go ahead, you're on the air.
My question is in regards to the Libertarian Party and what influence votes towards Gary Johnson and other third parties, what that may have done as far as stealing votes from Governor Romney and President Obama. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome, Rob. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Simon, in the work that you were doing, did some of these third-party candidates show up?
Oh, well, they do show up in the polls, typically under a catch-all, just other. And this was a cycle where I think two things to say about that. It was a cycle where that was never going to be a big factor. This was not 1992 with Perot running, or even 2000 with Nader, you know, taking votes away from Al Gore. It never looked like it was going to be that kind of a cycle. And I think most of us in the looking at the polls very carefully, were happy to sort of treat that as a tiny residual category and didn't pay much attention to it. Given how close some of the states have turned out to be, that might have been a little risky, but we have by and large gotten away with that this time around. The other thing I wanted to say about that is it's just that when you're talking about tiny proportions, candidates pulling tiny, tiny proportions of support, as the minor candidates did this year, by and large, it's extremely difficult to poll about them. And what happens is that there's tremendous variation across the polls in how well they pick up support for those candidates. A big driver of it is if you mention the name of the candidate mm-hmm. when you ask the vote question. If you just say Obama, Romney, or haven't you made up your mind yet, or if you just say Obama or Romney and leave it at that, and then the respondent has to volunteer something like they haven't made up their mind, they don't know, or they're thinking of voting for Gary Johnson or something like that, those subtle differences in the question wording produce big differences across the polls as to the proportions of support you're seeing for the minor candidates. And they're incredibly noisy for that reason, hard to model, hard to sort of feed in to these poll tracking algorithms. And, you know, I was sort of happy that this year turned out to be, a more simple case to handle than, say, a 2000 or a 1992 where you had a big chunk of the vote going to a third-party candidate.
Rob, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Simon, we have about 5 minutes before we have to say goodbye to you, and I have a question. I do want to get a caller or two on. And this is what you do, and Nate Silver and people like you, is using data, obviously. And I'm assuming we are leaving you just a, you know, breadcrumb trail of data about ourselves that you are then using to figure out how we vote?
Less so individual by individual, but you know, more collectively. And certainly this particular exercise is designed to work at the state level.
Right.
And maybe some drill down below that, you know, if we want to make this work, congressional district by congressional district, we'd need, you know, just a lot more data, a lot more polling data than what we have at the moment. So there are real limits to this, and to some extent, it's only as good as the data going in, and right now, there's just a ton of data from coming out of the national level and out of, you know, say, 8 or 9 swing states, and we did well there.
Let me see how Laura from Mount Airy, how she feels and what she has to say. Laura, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're
I
welcome.
Love your show.
Thank you.
Simon, my question is about how you think that the success of the data approach, and I'm a huge fan of Nate Silver, how that will reshape the likes of how journalists cover this. You know, to what extent will folks like Anderson Cooper be holding the pundits accountable when they talk about their gut checks?
Well, that's an interesting way to put it, Laura. Thanks for calling into Radio Time. Simon, go ahead.
I really hope that's what happens. you know, we have a saying around, you know, Stanford, you know, in God we trust, all others must bring data. You know, you don't get to, in a scientific world that I live in, you know, most of the time, you know, you just don't say things because you're an important, famous person. You say things because you've got strong reasons to believe in them, backed up by theory, you know, and even better, theory that's been tested by data. And those are the rules of the game for scientists. I don't know necessarily why it follows there ought to be different rules of the game when you're on TV and being entertaining in the first instance, but perhaps being entertaining and rigorous and sensible and rational at the same time.
Laura, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Simon, I'm curious how much the loss of landlines has changed the work that you do and other people that do polling.
It's a huge deal in the industry at the moment. You know, and one of the things will be, and not just me, but I think lots of people will be looking at performance of individual pollsters based on where they line up on that particular issue you just identified. The ability to get into cell phone-only households is a huge deal in the phone-based polling industry. You cannot auto-dial, that is, use a computer to dial a cell phone. That's against the law in the United States. For that reason, the cost of getting into those households, you've got to have humans making the calls, and so that tends to, you know, make it a more expensive proposition. Also, getting the lists of cell phone numbers in the first place is not straightforward either. So it's posing a real challenge to the polling industry, and perhaps one of the single biggest issues confronting the industry at the moment is sort of, you know, plummeting response rates across various modes of surveying, but also running into this problem of traditional sort of random digit dial to landlines no longer getting the coverage of the American population that it once did.
And I guess we're almost out of time here, but then obviously in the work that you do, you have to figure out how to factor that into your formulas and your data.
Well, not just me, right, but individual pollsters, sure, depending on how they're doing their work, right? This is an issue for many, many people in the industry, and absolutely you've got to factor that in, and you're sort of, you know, having to upweight or downweight the people you did get to try and make them representative of the population, and that's another source of potential error for any given pollster.
Well, Simon Jackman, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. I appreciate you getting up so early.
After a big night last night.
Exactly.
Thank you. Okay.
Okay, bye-bye. We'll be right back.
Are you or is someone you know overweight? Drexel University is currently enrolling overweight participants in Mind Your Health, a research study evaluating methods of losing weight and keeping it off without medication. These programs are funded by the National Institutes of Health. More information online at drexel.edu/weightloss or 215-762-4900. That's 215-762-4900. Drexel supports WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A divided electorate, a divided Congress. Can the U.S. become any more polarized than it already is? And what does that mean post-election? Also, a break from politics with jazz singer Melody Gardot. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Princeton Academy of the Sacred Heart announces an open house Sunday, November 11th at 1 p.m. Princeton Academy takes advantage of the growing body of research on the differences between the ways in which boys and girls develop. A junior kindergarten through 8th grade independent school for boys, the Academy embraces the nature of boys and nurtures their development. The school's curriculum is designed to engage boys and inspire them to explore, discover, and learn. 609-924-8143 or princetonacademy.org.
This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. The 2012 election was a contentious and hard-fought battle, especially when it came to voter ID laws. Many of them were delayed or blocked, but still there was some confusion among voters about their right to vote, including here in Pennsylvania. There was also a fight over early voting in some states, and many people waited in line for hours to cast their ballot. Here's what the president said about that last night.
I want to thank every American who participated in this election. Whether you voted for the very first time or waited in line for a very long time. By the way, we have to fix that.
And joining us now is Ari Berman. He's a writer for The Nation magazine and investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. He's written extensively about American politics and foreign policy, the intersection of money and politics. And joining us once again today on Radio Times. Ari, nice to have you with us on the show.
Hey, Mari. Thanks for having me back.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, we are talking about the right to vote. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Ari, in many ways, a test of the country's election system, its system of voting. How would you say the system fared?
Well, I think the president is right. We do need to fix this system. This election, to me, was a case study in how not to run elections. And I think it's pretty hypocritical for us to be exporting democracy all around the world, but unable to run elections competently at home. And we saw a lot of problems, both in the run-up to the election and on election day, people being asked for ID that was not required, people having to wait in extremely long lines to vote, people not on the voting rolls when they should have been, voting machines breaking down, partisan secretaries of state changing the rules at the 11th hour. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And this really was a culmination, I think, of attempts to restrict the right to vote by the GOP since the 2010 election. Luckily, it seems like almost everyone who wanted to participate was able to participate, but they had to jump through an enormous number of hurdles to do so. And I think now that the election's over, I would hope that both parties can come to an agreement that we should be making it easier for people to vote, not harder in this country.
And in Pennsylvania, there is a voter ID law. It was upheld by a judge, but essentially postponed. And there was, I would say, Ari, some anecdotal information about voter confusion, some voting places with frankly, misleading signs about whether people needed an ID or not. Is there any way to know whether this was by design or just the kind of confusion of trying to institute a voting system that's still in flux?
It seemed like it was more confusion than suppression, although you have to remember, in many ways, confusion is a form of suppression. But what seemed like was happening in Pennsylvania was poll workers, for one reason or another, were wrongly telling some voters that they needed an ID to vote. I think some of this was due to the confusing nature of the ruling by Judge Simpson, the second ruling, I might add, by Judge Simpson in the voter ID case, basically telling poll workers, you can ask for ID, but it's not required for voters to show it, which was a confusing way to interpret the law. It would have been easier if he just said, don't ask for the ID because people don't need it. So we had situations where poll workers in Pennsylvania were telling people they needed an ID that they actually didn't need. Some people were being turned away. Other people were being forced to cast provisional ballots. There were signs outside some polling places saying that they needed an ID that they didn't need. There were instances of people being told to go to many different polling places to cast a ballot. People were also showing up and being told that they weren't on the voter rolls. We still don't know why that was. So Pennsylvania sounded pretty chaotic. I wasn't there, but from everything I observed, it sounded pretty chaotic. And I think that's a result of the fact that the legislature passed a voter ID law in March of 2012, which is a very, very late time to pass a law that's going to be instituted basically 6 or 7 months later. And then you had multiple court decisions, not just one decision, but multiple court decisions saying different things about the law so close to the election. The last ruling, I believe, happened basically less than a month before the election. So this is not how elections should be run in this country. I don't believe we need a photo ID law, but if we're going to do it, we at least need to do it with enough time so that everyone has ID and knows what the law is.
I do want to get to our callers. We have a lot of people that want to talk to you, Ari, but I also want to get your response to some of those long lines. And on the one hand, you could say, isn't that inspirational that people are willing to wait 8 hours to cast their ballot? On the other hand, who can do that? I mean, who can set aside 8 hours or 4 hours to vote? And do you think there were certain segments of the population that were disadvantaged by those long lines?
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you're a working person, you can't spend 8 hours in line. If you can't afford a babysitter and you have kids, you can't wait in that line. If you have to get to your shift or your job, you can't wait in an 8-hour line. So this absolutely disenfranchises people who are less well-off in society, and I think it's great we have long turnout. But if we had a more sophisticated election system where people were easily registered to vote and there was enough resources devoting to polling places and to voting machines and people knew what the laws were and they had enough time to vote, we wouldn't have seen these long lines. So in Ohio, for example, early voting was cut from about 35 days to around 3 weeks, and they banned early voting on weekends, on nights, and on extended business hours, except for the last 3 days before the election when they had limited weekend hours. There's no reason we should be doing that. We should be allowing people to vote on weekends. We should be allowing people to vote in extended hours. We shouldn't just vote on election day. I think Pennsylvania needs to look at how it runs elections and institute early voting like so many other states have done to try to mitigate problems on election day.
Let me get Margaret from West Philadelphia to join our conversation. And Margaret, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm just calling to point out that there were ads run by the Pennsylvania Department of State on TV on Election Day saying, if you want to vote, if you want to make a difference, then show it. And then they had images of IDs, and then they said something like, you will be asked for ID, you don't need it to vote, but we want you to get ready for next year. I cannot see how anyone can interpret that as any other way than trying to prevent people from voting. Because why run these ads on the election day when you don't need the ID for the election?
Well, Margaret,
I mean, if they want people to get ready, they could start running them the day after the election.
Margaret, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And since we're on the radio, Ari, the show at big letters and the fine print was about you don't actually have to have it, but the show it were the big letters.
Yeah, and it should have been the opposite. I mean, the big letters should have said, you don't need ID. And the small print could have said, hey, there's going to be a trial after the election to decide whether you actually need that ID going forward. The state really seemed unwilling to pull its advertising. I think the state was basically operating from the assumption that they wanted an ID law, even though the judge said that the ID law was not going to be in effect. And so they really didn't shift their advertising quickly enough. You saw, for example, last-minute briefs filed before Judge Simpson saying that the state should pull its advertising. It never ended up doing so. There were reports of people receiving a flyer saying they needed ID to vote right before the election or on election day. And so, again, we don't know if this was deliberate suppression by the state or they just thought that this was the best way to get the message out. But I don't think they were operating in a way that really served the needs of voters.
Let me see what Janet from Lehighton has to say. Janet, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Yesterday when I tried to vote, I had the same experience as your earlier caller. When I got there, the poll worker said, you might want to get out your ID in order to get into the habit of doing it next time. But what was worse than that was that when I went to the voting machine itself, it repeatedly changed my choice to the opposite party. I had to keep touching the screen over and over again in order to get the candidate registered that I wanted. And at the end of it, When I cast my vote, although the last screen identified correctly all the names that I had chosen, I have no confidence whatsoever that my vote actually registered the way I wanted it to. And I thought this voter ID law was supposed to ensure the accuracy of a person's vote and not cheat anybody who was legally qualified to vote out of casting their vote. And I feel like I got cheated yesterday.
Jenna, did you complain to the people at your polling place? Did you explain what was happening when you voted?
I did. And the poll worker said, oh, those machines are always touchy. Which is not true. I voted there for 7 years, and I never had that problem before. But beside the point, if they really are touchy, why aren't you doing something about it?
Well, Jenna, let me see what Ari Berman has to say. Thanks for calling into Radio Times, Jenna. Go ahead, Ari.
Marty, do you know if voting machines in Pennsylvania have a paper ballot backup? Because I'm not actually sure if they do.
We can try to check that online. I'm looking at Debbie Builder. She's going to jump on the phone to call someone to see if we can figure that out.
But anyway, if they don't, I think that's obviously something that every state should have. Another thing I'll point out is just the problem with poll workers. I think poll workers are trying to do the best job they can, but they're not getting enough training. Training is the basis of the counties. It's not required by the state. Poll workers were not trained, I don't believe, 3 weeks before the election. And what the latest on the voter ID law said, the fact that the law was modified so many times that it was passed in March of 2012, it was initially upheld by a judge in April of 2012. Then the Supreme Court vacated the ruling in September 2012. Then a judge came back and had this strange thing where you didn't need the ID, but poll workers could ask for it a month later, created a lot of confusion. I think it created confusion among poll workers as well about exactly what the law is. The median age of poll workers in the U.S. is 72 years old. So if that's the median age, we're clearly getting a lot of elderly residents of the state who might not be on email, they might not be online, they might not be following the latest day-to-day back and forth on Twitter. And so I think we just need to do a much better job of preparing our election officials for what the law is and making sure they have the resources so voters don't face all this confusion and chaos on election day.
Jenna, thanks for the call. Let's get Daniel from, looks like Telford, to join us on Radio Times. And Daniel, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Marty.
You're welcome.
My question was, I just wondered if you thought that Internet security would ever be at a point where people might be able to vote from home electronically.
And I know that happens in some countries. Ari Berman, is that in our future, do you think?
Well, New Jersey experimented with this by allowing people who were hit by Sandy to vote over email, and it was not a good experience because the email servers were not set up to handle it. It basically, the incoming traffic crashed the servers, and a lot of people were not able to vote by email. I do think eventually we've got to figure out a way to modernize the way we both register voters and vote. The thing that I think we most need to do in American elections is automatically register people to vote. When I'm 18, I'm automatically enrolled in Selective Service. When I'm born, I'm automatically enrolled in Social Security. I think that's something that we need to do with voting. Instead of putting the onus on the voter to register to vote, and then if they move to update their registration, if they move to a different state to update their registration, just make it simple. Make it so that people are automatically registered to vote, they get a voter registration card, or they get something online, and then they can update it easily. And I think if we do that, not only will we give voting rights to 50 million people who aren't registered to vote, but we'll mitigate a lot of the problems that we have of people showing up and not being on the voting rolls. And I think the next step is to allow people to be able to if not vote online, to at least be able to access the documents they need online. And another thing that we should be doing is having election day registration in states. States that allow you to show up, register to vote, and then vote have much higher turnout, up to 10% higher turnout than states that don't. It's worked very well in places like Wisconsin and Minnesota. There's no reason that every state shouldn't have it at this point.
Daniel, thanks for the call to Radio Times. All right, let me ask you about poll watchers, and there's nothing new about poll watchers. That's been part of our election tradition. What are they allowed to do? And perhaps this, you know, we talked about this before the election, but what are their rights and responsibilities?
Well, it varies in state by state. In some states, you can challenge a voter with no documentation, and that voter has to cast a provisional ballot. In other states, it's much more difficult to challenge voters. In certain states, poll watchers can actually become poll workers and be inside the polling place. We heard a lot about this before the election with True the Vote, the Tea Party group that claimed to be recruiting 1 million poll watchers to try to root out what they claim to be voter fraud on Election Day. I think the group basically had a more bark than bite. There didn't seem to be nearly as many as 1 million poll watchers. They didn't seem to have any impact. They didn't find, as far as I know, any fraud. And the ironic thing is that in Columbus, Ohio, True the Vote asked to become GOP poll workers, be inside the polling place. To do so, they needed 5 signatures from candidates to be able to become poll workers. They submitted forms with signatures from the candidates. Then when the candidates realized who True the Vote was, they rescinded their signatures, but nonetheless True the Vote provided another batch of documents with those same signatures on them. So they either copied or forged the signatures, which for a group that's devoted to stopping voter fraud, to have potentially committed election fraud in a pivotal swing state like Ohio, I think really harms their credibility.
And Ari, we're out of time and up, but I'm just getting a note here. No paper ballots in Pennsylvania.
Well, that's another thing we have to fix.
Lots to fix in our electoral system. Ari, thanks for joining us
today,
Radio Times. You're welcome. And he's a writer for The Nation magazine and investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute, the third of 3 guests in this hour of Radio Times, talking about the election of 2012, last night's results, and talking with Ari about how we vote in this country. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, email and the archives, and much more there for you to check out. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant helping us out. I'm Marty Moscone. Thank you so much for joining us.